Thank you, Mr. Henderson, and good morning to you all, and to those on the web, and to those in Newfoundland, hello for the second time in just a few days. It's good to see everybody today. It seems like so much was crammed into the last 4 days that it feels much more than a week since we were here on the Sabbath with you just 7 days ago. Travel in the winter, of course, in this area can be treacherous at times, as we know. Unlike today and tomorrow, it's just going to be windy in this area, but quite warm, at least no snow to deal with. Travel just about 4 hours by air to the northeast, especially east, to Newfoundland, and that can be multiplied. The day before our arrival in St. John's, we arrived Tuesday in time to go to the funeral home for the calling hours, initial calling hours on Tuesday night. The area had 41 centimeters of snow on Monday. That was the official measurement. It was much more in some areas. That's just over 16 inches. For those of you who hadn't quite made the conversion to the English system or the imperial system instead of the metric. The streets were clear when we got there. That was the good news. But the giant piles or mounds of snow had not been removed yet. That really is the problem in so many areas. You can clear the streets and get rid of the problems to travel, but to then remove the piles of snow that you've shoved off to the side becomes an issue, especially when it starts to melt. Some of the drifts we had in our hotel, a couple of very impressive snow piles that were stacked somewhere between 10 and 12 feet high in the corners of the parking lot. I was not tempted to tunnel into them, though. I thought it was going to look a lot more pleasant inside the hotel. It wasn't that cold. The temperature was right around freezing, within a couple of degrees one way or the other, but clearly the snow was impressive. 3 meters high, at least, the drifts, 10 feet plus. Both my wife and I have been doing a great deal of thinking and talking about those few days. As I said, they were so compressed and crammed with so many things event-wise, including travel issues coming back. The plane that we were supposed to fly back on Thursday morning never made it to St. John's on Wednesday night, so that makes it a little hard to fly, as I'm not a spirit being yet, and makes it a little tough. So our flight was canceled. At least we knew that before we went to bed, because the flight was due to leave St. John's at 5:05 a.m. local time. That would be 3:35 a.m. here. We knew before we went to bed, thankfully, so we didn't bother to get up in time to get to the airport. Initially, they were rescheduling us to fly home today. And so I called. I actually had to go to the airport to talk to somebody, because then the phone lines become so jammed they weren't even putting you on hold. It was just saying, thank you for calling. Unless your flight is scheduled for the next 24 hours, don't even bother. And I'm talking into the phone saying, but my flight is scheduled within the next 24 hours. But that didn't make any difference, so I went down to the airport, and all three people who were there were very kind. And I talked to an agent at the desk who was very helpful. In fact, when we boarded the plane finally Thursday night at 6 o'clock to get out halfway home to Toronto, well, three quarters, but she recognized me. She said, oh, you had to wait until now. So she was very kind and helpful. But we've been doing a great deal of thinking and talking about those few days. We renewed contact with a small handful of people that we'd come to know a bit in the last 3.5 years. Counting this trip now, we've made 5 trips in the last 42 months. So it's very familiar. I even know some of the shortcuts to get places now, which is interesting. We met many more on this trip for the first time, of course, from Blanche's family. She had 6 siblings, and they all survive her. I was honored to be asked by David Smith to give the funeral sermon at the service. Each of their 2 daughters, Carmel and Karen, were there, and David himself, all three of them gave eulogies. The stories they had to tell, and watching the reaction from those gathered, and meeting Blanche's sisters especially. The 2 sisters looked like they could have been twins just about. But it was interesting talking to them all and seeing the similarities and hearing the stories. It was a window into a person, and as I spoke in the funeral service, I had to ask myself, and how do you speak to this group? Everyone there, with the exception of my wife, had known Blanche Smith a great deal longer than I had. And because of her health trial, the issues going back over 15 years, that gradually had an effect of wearing her down and eroding her and not changing the essential person that she was or her convictions or beliefs, that much was always clear. But it still changes a person and it makes it difficult. And so my wife and I never knew the Blanche Smith that everyone else there gathered to hear the message had. So how do you speak to that group? As it happened, I had taken along a children's book that she wrote for her grandson because he was so fascinated with backhoes and excavators and earth-moving equipment that she'd written a story and called it Digger Donald about an excavator that was going to help dig wells on a farm. And her daughter Carmel illustrated it with drawings, so I thought I'll take that with me and say this is the woman who gave me the clue to what she was like by giving me a little storybook for our grandson, William. As I told them, I was under strict instructions to return it when I got home and not keep it because it belongs to William now. But interestingly enough, her daughter Carmel held up the same book when she came to give her eulogy. And so that was an interesting touch because when I got up and held it, I said, this is not the same copy. Carmel still has hers down there. But it was a connection, and it was a clue from Blanche herself to that previous life and that person that we really did not know. She made it straightforward herself by connecting it. Hearing so many accounts from those who were there, who did know her well, her family and her friends of many, many years, of the years before a difficult health trial impacted her as it would any of us. But even in our brief friendship, the time that we had known her and her husband David, 3.5 years, we saw the telltale signs of her convictions. And that's what I wanted to focus on in the message. Her desire to fulfill God's purpose in her life. That's her legacy. That's what she leaves as the most important message of her life. Her convictions and her clinging and holding to them faithfully. Blanche would have been 76 years old next month. She was 75, not quite 76. Her husband David just turned 78. How did she do that? How did she create that legacy? How did she hold to her convictions? How did I and how did my wife know what we were seeing? Because I'm sure that in some regards, those who hadn't seen her for years would perhaps have come up to pay their respects in the funeral home and taken a look and say, that's not the woman I knew. Because there were changes. But how did we know what had been before? Brethren, the connection has to do with what it is that drives and motivates our obedience to God. Because in Blanche Smith, that never changed. That never changed. Even though the physical does. And it does in all of us, of course. That was what we could see through the veil of the health trial. It's something that comes from the application of the power of God's Spirit in a person's life. And that's something you and I are very much into, very much wanting to focus on and take advantage of, a power source available to only those God has called and given it. Jesus said, no man can come to me except the Father draw him, John 6:44 and 6:65. We understand that. Let's get some background first. So let's go back to Exodus 20. Now some of this material I have given before in other sermons. I won't make an apology for that because I don't think each of you here has a photographic memory to recall every one of the sermons I've given in 14 years. If you have, I'm very impressed. Can you please let me know what they were so I can remember them? Obviously, Exodus 20 is a number that we're familiar with, the chapter. It's the chapter where the Ten Commandments are thundered from Mount Sinai. This may not immediately seem to follow the direction of the introduction in the sermon today, but please bear with me because I think you'll see how it does connect. Because what I talked about was its application in one specific person. But what I want to talk about today is how it can be applied in every one of our lives. So let's go to the part after the Ten Commandments were pronounced from the mountain. That ends in verse 17 with the calling out of the tenth commandment, the one that deals not with sin overtly, but in the mind. You shall not covet is the tenth commandment. Your neighbor's house, your neighbor's wife, his male servant, his female servant, his ox, his donkey, anything that is your neighbor's, his Ferrari, you know, any of those things. Now all the people witnessed the thunderings, verse 18, the lightning flashes, the sound of the trumpet, the mountain smoking. And when the people saw it, they trembled and stood afar off. Then they said to Moses, "You speak with us, and we will hear." How did that work out in succeeding years? "But let not God speak with us, lest we die." So there's the people's reaction to what they had experienced. It's understandable, I think, all things considered. What if you were gathered with a huge group of perhaps 2 to 3 million people? We're told 600,000 men left Egypt. What about the women and children and all the animals? It must have been a massive, massive exodus. And you saw thunderings and lightnings, and you could feel the ground shaking. And then you heard some sounds that made you want to cover your ears and run shrieking. And yet a voice that you could recognize thundered these words. Remember, this was long before the days of any electronic enhancement. This was not webcast back to Cairo or Memphis or Ramses or any of those cities of Egypt. This was on the spot. And so I think it's a bit understandable. We need to be charitable that way and understand we might have been in the same predicament. But then in verses 20 and 21, we see something deeper, if we can understand it. Verse 20 is a little bit puzzling at first. Is Moses telling them to fear or not to fear? So let's read it and look at the context. Moses said to the people, "Do not fear. For God has come to test you so that his fear may be before you." So, like I said, which is it? Fear or not fear? "So that you may not sin." The two times fear is used in the verse, the words are very similar and they have the same root. But the first one has just a slightly different shade of meaning to it. It has a kind of a causative sense. It's as if he's telling them, don't let all that, the physical miracles of the smoking mountain and the thundering voice, don't let all of that make you afraid or make you fear God. The second time when he says his fear may be before you, it's a simpler form of the basic word in Hebrew. Now he's just saying you need to keep a right and a proper awe. That kind of fear of God's great power always in the forefront of your mind so that you obey him and you don't sin. Let it be that kind of fear that allows us to say, I don't want the results that would come from going against his word. And the reason, of course, God said those things is for their and our own good. Then verse 21 is also fascinating because it shows the different reactions of Moses and the people. Verse 21, "So the people stood afar off, but Moses drew near the thick blackness where God was." They pulled back. They held back. Moses drew closer. Think about that. Now, with that as a background, let's get to the core of the material for today. It's in the form of a question, big surprise. If you've heard me give sermons these last 14 years, you know I'm quite capable of asking a lot of questions in a sermon, and I don't always answer them all. I figure that's your job, that's your homework. I don't have to do all the work. So it's in the form of a question, one which we should continue to think about as we consider the lives and the legacies of so many of God's faithful servants. It's certainly the train of thought was triggered this week for me in seeing that up close again and seeing the impact on other lives in a way that I had not been able to see in our first four visits to the area because I had not met so many of these other people before, and they were so warm and so welcoming, almost without question. One lady we met was the daughter of a member of the Church of God Worldwide Association, and she's just the kindest and sweetest person you can imagine. She came flying up to give both of us hugs afterwards, before the service, actually. We hadn't seen her for about a year and a half. The question is this: why do you obey God? Now, if you're taking notes, maybe you should change the pronoun to I. Or you could put it you and show it to your neighbor next to you and ask them with a question in your face, you know, like, why do you obey God? But it might be more helpful if we took it personally. Now, it sounds a bit strange, but it addresses a very basic human trait on very common ground. And it most certainly goes all the way back to ancient Israel, which is where we started today in Exodus 20. Yet it is as current as any late-breaking news on your smartphone. Why do people act the way they do? Some things don't really change that much over generations of time. People do. Circumstances do. Lifestyles change. I imagine our current, present, rather hectic lifestyle would be a shock to people who could, say, come back from 100 years ago or 200 years ago. They would be horrified by parts of it, I'm convinced. Why do people act the way they do? Why do they make the choices they make? What motivates them in life? What kind of results do they get based on those choices and also based on the reasons behind the choices? It goes a little deeper. All of it connects. The answer to why we obey God is very likely to tie into how we obey God. Why we do it impacts how we do it. And that's because there's more than one level of obedience. Now, any of you who are parents know that. If you tell your kid to clean up his room, the reaction you get will tell you a little bit about the reasons for doing it. Let's take a look at that in the next part of the sermon. And after that, there's another and maybe even deeper, or at least a causal, not casual, if you're taking notes, causal connection we can make. Same letters spelled a little differently. Let's see if we can figure it out. I'll give credit where credit is due to a friend in the ministry, Mr. David Johnson, even though he teases me unmercifully whenever he gets the chance, but we're good friends and no particular relation. Well, I guess we are if you go all the way back to Noah, but the Johnson in this case is, although we both come from St. Louis too, so I'm not sure about that. Maybe there's a cousin lurking in the weeds I never knew about. But we even root for the same baseball team, which is really frightening. But he is the David Johnson who is not my brother. As you know, I have a brother named David Johnson, but that's another story. It's based on some research that he's done in his capacity as a teacher at Foundation Institute, which is one of the reasons for his most recent giving me a little tease, and he was only picking up where Mr. Franks had. He has recently decided to step down from the doctrine committee because of his responsibilities there and focus on teaching. So Mr. Franks had asked me if I would take that spot and replace him, and his reason was we need at least one Johnson on the doctrine committee. So that's strange humor. But some research that he's done on the book of Galatians in some presentations we have in our ministerial seminars and training classes. It's not come out yet, to my knowledge, on FI Online. Some of the material in this sermon, a great deal of it, in fact, came from his research. I did a little more myself. And it suggests that we human beings respond to God from three basic but slightly different motivations. In fact, quite different in some cases. So let's take a look at them, because I think we would probably see this even in our examples of our own children and our own upbringing and our own growth as kids, and some of the stunts we tried to pull on our parents to convince them we were doing what they said, in name only, perhaps. The first reason for obedience, or the first motivation, is compliance. Compliance. Now, what does that mean? Let's use an example. I've already alluded to one, that is your kids. You tell your kid to clean up your room. Compliance might be, you know, the rolled eyeballs. Now, surely none of you as parents ever saw rolled eyeballs in your family. You know, you get this look. You know, the deep sigh. Okay, yes, Mom, yes, Dad, and it gets done, sort of. At least the piles are shifted so they no longer block your access to walking about in the room. That's compliance. Let me give you another example. Maybe this one relates more to you or to me. Suppose you're driving on the highway, and you happen to spot a police car up ahead, as I did not last year when we were in Alberta and had to take a side trip because of a snowstorm, and I did not spot the police car, and I did not spot the speed limit sign dropping from 80 kilometers an hour to 50 kilometers an hour as I went through a little poke and plum town that we couldn't even see in the snow. Yes, I did get a ticket. The second in my life, the first in 30 years. I was only 8 years old when I got the first one. Okay, not so. But suppose you spot this trooper, policeman, Mountie, to include everybody, on the highway. What do you do almost automatically? Well, unless you're an idiot, you don't speed up. Almost, I would say, universally, 9 times out of 10, you slow down. Now, if you're on cruise control and you know you're okay, maybe you don't. But even if you're on cruise control, sometimes you tap those brakes and let it just drift back a little bit. I know you do. It may not even matter if you know that you're within the grace allowance, we might say, most people figure they'll be given, you know, a few miles per hour or kilometers per hour over the limit. Maybe you do it even if you know you are at or below the speed limit. You might still slow down. It's just almost an inbred response. Now, that's precisely the reason the police officer or the trooper or the Mountie is there, to control the flow of traffic at levels that are near the speed limit. Because you will always get people who think they can travel a lot faster. And amazingly to me, even in poor driving conditions. We all see things like that. And I'm sure we say it to ourselves as someone goes flying past. We probably mutter under our breath, I sure hope you get pulled over for speeding so that you don't cause an accident. That's what we're thinking. We don't want you to be hurt in any way. We don't want anything bad to happen to you, so we hope you get pulled over for speeding. That would be on our really good days. If any tickets have to be given out to those who are speeding excessively, it still reinforces the basic goal, which is to make the traffic flow safer. That's the goal. Unless you have a persecution complex, you don't think they're just out there to get you. But why do we react the way we do? That's just analyzing what happens, how we obey that limit. But the question has to go deeper. Why? Why do we do it? Why do we slow down? Is it because, here's one possibility, we love police officers and troopers and Mounties so much that we would not want them to be disappointed in us personally in the way we drive? Is that why we slow down? If so, you're a better person than I am. Is it a step less altruistic than that? Is it because we are immediately reminded of those terrible films we saw in Driver Training, or the crashed, mangled cars that we saw pictures of, or were given tours of at some kind of a police facility, as sometimes happens, and we then completely relate to the reasons the city planners or highway authorities posted the limit at exactly what they did, even though we don't think it makes any sense and we don't understand it, so that we're completely in sync in our minds with the limit, so we perfectly identify with all of the factors leading up to that traffic law being what it is. Is that why we slow down? You're probably saying, you've got to be kidding. You're overthinking this. And yes, I am. What is it then? Why do we do that? Why do we slow down? Pretty simple. We don't want a ticket. End of story. We don't want a ticket because then we're going to get points on our license, and if we do that often enough, we'll get our license taken away, and that makes life inconvenient at best. That's why we don't speed. In other words, our obedience to the traffic speed limits is due to compliance. We do it because we don't want to deal with the consequences of breaking the law. In a way, you could say we do it out of fear. Fear of the consequences. Now, it has good results. We drive a little more sanely at a safer limit. Of course, there are other problems too. On occasion, you see someone driving too slow for the conditions, and that's not good either, because that also can cause an accident. You're better to go with the flow of traffic as long as it's, you know, reasonable. But if you're on an interstate where the speed limit is 70 miles an hour and you see someone out there doing 45, there's a minimum. If you've seen the posted limits, the signs, you must do at least 40 on an interstate, at least 40. And even that's not really safe. That's not really safe. When the traffic is moving at 70 to 75, if you're doing 40, you are a hazard on the interstate. So if your vehicle cannot do that speed, or if the driver cannot do that speed, you need to take back roads, probably, where it's safer. But the question is really, how does that work for us spiritually? Can you think of an example from the Bible of obedience done simply out of fear? Because he, she, they just didn't want to have to deal with the consequences of disobedience. Well, where did we start today? Ancient Israel. Take a look at the 78th Psalm. Psalm 78. Verse 5, "For he established a testimony in Jacob, and appointed a law in Israel, which he commanded our fathers, that they should make them known to their children, that the generation to come might know them, the children who would be born, that they may arise and declare them to their children, that they may set their hope in God and not forget the works of God, but keep his commandments, and may not be like their fathers, a stubborn and rebellious generation, a generation that did not set its heart aright, and whose spirit was not faithful to God. The children of Ephraim, being armed and carrying bows, turned back in the day of battle. They did not keep the covenant of God. They refused to walk in his law, and they forgot his works and his wonders that he had shown them." Keep on reading for a little bit. "Marvelous things he did in the sight of their fathers in the land of Egypt, in the field of Zoan. He divided the sea and caused them to pass through. He made the waters stand up like a heap. In the daytime he led them with the cloud, and all the night with a light of fire. He split the rocks in the wilderness and gave them drink in abundance like the depths. He also brought streams out of the rock and caused waters to run down like rivers. But they sinned even more against him by rebelling against the Most High in the wilderness. And they tested God in their heart by asking for the food of their fancy. Yes, they spoke against God. They said, can God prepare a table in the wilderness? Behold, he struck the rock so that the waters gushed out, the streams overflowed. Can he give bread also? Can he provide meat for his people? Therefore, the Eternal heard this, and he was furious. So a fire was kindled against Jacob, and anger came up against Israel, because they did not believe in God. If you want to know what makes God angry, it's when we don't believe him, because he's only trying to do things and instruct us and teach us for our own good. He doesn't hate you or hate me or hate any peoples. The problem is we're not responding to his love. They did not believe in God and did not trust in his salvation. Interesting words. There's so much more. Drop down a few verses, and here's the core result, verse 34. When he slew them, then they sought him. Now, obviously not the people who were dead, but the nation. And they returned and sought earnestly for God. Then they remembered that God was their rock, and the Most High God their Redeemer. Nevertheless, it says, they flattered him with their mouth, they lied to him with their tongue. Their heart was not steadfast with him, nor were they faithful to his covenant. You notice the phrases in verses 34 and 35, then. Then they sought him, and then they remembered. What was their obedience from? Verse 40, how often they provoked him in the wilderness and grieved him in the desert. Yes, again and again they tempted God and limited the Holy One of Israel. That's one of my favorite verses to remember. They tempted God and limited the Holy One of Israel. They did not remember his power. First part of verse 42. Now verse 56. Yet they tested and provoked the Most High God, did not keep his testimonies, but turned back and acted unfaithfully like their fathers. Even the younger generation, having been given a new lease on life, the ability to take as an inheritance the promised land, after the death of the older generation, all who were more than 20 at the time they left Egypt were gone, with two notable exceptions, Joshua and Caleb. Compare to Deuteronomy chapter 5. This is a verse you probably remember well. A couple of verses. Deuteronomy 5, verse 28. Deuteronomy 5, 28. Then the Eternal heard the voice of your words when you spoke to me, and the Lord said to me, I have heard the voice of the words of this people which they have spoken to you. They are right in all that they have spoken. What's another way of expressing that? They are right in all that they have spoken. Wouldn't we say, you said all the right words? It's like telling your kid to clean the room. Yes, Mom. Those are the right words. But oh, so different from, yes, Mom. Thank you for reminding me. So that I do not step on a truck and slide and break my ankle and have to have you wait on me hand and foot for 3 weeks. Oh, wait a minute. Very different. So they said all the right words, God told Moses. But verse 29, oh, that they had such a heart in them, that they would fear me and always keep all my commandments. And here's why. That it might be well with them and with their children forever. Basically, God told Moses, they said all the right words, but they didn't mean it in their hearts. And yes, parents, we have seen that at some time or other. And if you don't recall that you were like that as a child, they say memory gets bad as you get older. It because I'm sure we all did it. All of us. Yes, you too. And the name involved rhymes with the words you and two, but I won't speak. No, anyway, we've all done that. We've all done that, haven't we? We obey, maybe at first, just like the ancient Israelites in our lives. In other words, they complied because they didn't like the results of disobedience. Whenever they obeyed as much as they did, Israel, which was at times somewhat limited, it was because they didn't want to have the results. The entire book of Judges basically relates that story over and over and over again. We obey sometimes as God first begins working with us, initially perhaps a little bit the same. Maybe not with the attitude so much, not with the rolled eyeballs, not with a yes, Mom. But still, maybe at first our obedience is more of the compliant quality. Because we see that there's a purpose in obeying. You get better results in your life. It's not a magic wand. It doesn't mean you have no problems. Paul assured us, through much tribulation we shall enter the kingdom of God. There will be challenges. Some of them because we've chosen to obey God. Because we live in a world that doesn't. But at first, our initial obedience may be somewhat like this. We obey at first, maybe not because we really understand it all deeply yet, or are even yet totally motivated on a deep level, but because we can see there's a benefit to doing what God says. Or to put it more accurately, we can see there's a penalty for not doing what he says. And we don't want the penalty. And that's okay, for starters. You avoid the penalty. If your kid cleans up the room, even with a less than sterling attitude, then he won't step on that truck and he won't break his ankle and so on. But it needs to go deeper than that. Okay, what's the next level? The second level of obedience is identification. Identification. Sometimes people do what they do, not so much because they fear the consequences, but because they relate to others who are doing what they are doing. We've often said that the number of people in the Church of God, I'm talking historically now, not just the fellowship of the Church of God, a worldwide association, but going back years and years, decades and decades perhaps, even back into the days of the worldwide Church of God, or even earlier to when it was known as the Radio Church of God, which is what it was when my family first came in contact with it in the very late 50s and began attending church in 1960. Frankly, a lot of people made that initial contact by knowing somebody who was already in the church. And according to, I guess what you'd say, a growing amount of just general sociological research, this pattern of choice for our conduct is very prevalent in a current generation that we often refer to as the millennials. Interestingly enough, there are some parallels between the millennials and what we call the greatest generation going way back. Some parallels, mainly in the area of enjoying doing things together as a group. Now, it can be applied in different ways. There may be more positive elements of group think and group action than others. But there's a kind of a desire to be together. Years ago, we used to be given instructions or guidance, for example, on dating when we were in college. And we were told about a concept of making lots of friends. Don't pair off too early before you really get to know different types of personalities. But in our modern world, one-on-one single dating is not nearly as prevalent or popular universally as it used to be back then. People like to hang together in groups now, more often than not. Of course, we pair off later, but still. But the millennials, birth years generally thought to be 1982 through 2004, 2006, 2007, it's hard to identify completely, but 2004, These are the ones who, on their birthday this year, will be anywhere from the ages of roughly 16 to 38. That's an entire generation. The teens and young adults of our current world, our own church statistics would show that's a pretty significant portion of our church population. For a number of years, we have discovered that about 30% of those who attend the feast are under the age of 30. With Church of God, a worldwide association, that's a good thing. That's a good thing. And so for many, especially of this age group, the millennials, a feeling of belonging or identifying with others is extremely important and guided the right way. There's nothing wrong with that. You know, there are admonitions in the scriptures about the company we keep. A company of sinners is going to be thought a sinner. A company of righteous people will be given the benefit of the doubt in many cases. It's something common to all of us to a degree. It's not of and by itself wrong, but our response to God does need to go still deeper, and here's why. Do you remember, did you have parents who said something like this to you? If all your friends are going to jump off a bridge, are you going to jump off with them? Yeah, I suspect many of us heard that. Or something similar. You know, they had a point. If you were around in the Church of God, if you have been around for, let's say, the last 25 to 30 years, do you see what's happened? Do you see how it's changed? What happened to having 150,000 people attending the Feast of Tabernacles? Back in the mid-80s, early to mid-80s, I served a time as a feast coordinator when we were still living in Western Canada in Regina, Saskatchewan. And we thought that back then, the feast site, we thought, well, you know, this is a nice, small little feast site. We only have 1,200 to 1,500 people here. And at the time, that was accurate, a small little feast site. My wife had cousins who lived in Pensacola, and they were not in the Church of God, but they were very familiar with it because of the impact the church had on the community of Pensacola back in those days. One year, they had 15,000 people there for the feast. And her cousins used to write and say, "When are you coming to Pensacola for the Feast of Tabernacles?" You'd think they were attending it. No, but they knew we would, and they wanted to know when we'd come and visit them then. Sadly, it seemed like we most often got together with them at times of family funerals. But things have changed. It's not that way anymore. Even with all the various splits and divisions and branches and whatever of what came from the Church of God that had its roots in the old worldwide Church of God, that I don't know how many people that is total. Maybe 30,000? I just don't know. It's hard to say. But a significantly smaller proportion of what used to be. How did that happen? Why did it happen? How could people hear a message, for example, on the Sabbath from a man in the ministry, no matter what his position was, and immediately ask their pastors, as I had asked of me by two people on the same day we played a certain message, if it was okay to work on the Sabbath? When they had for years been refusing to. Same day. Or stop on the way home from church and enjoy a pepperoni pizza or a shrimp salad. Has also happened. My point is, why do you do what you do? And what does it take to make you stop doing that? Or to change your pattern of conduct? That's the question. Very possibly the answer is because, for some people, understandably, the most powerful motivator in their choice of direction came from their relationships. Their relationships. Not, please hear what I'm saying, not from a fixed code of conduct. There is a difference. If a large group that you identify with conducts itself a certain way, and if it's really important to you to be a part of that group, you tend to conduct yourself the same way. And to all outward appearances, you have the same motivations. But if you remove that, I guess you'd call it peer pressure, then what happens reveals what the real motivation was. And it changes. In other words, some may have wondered something like, seeing a change in pronouncements from church leadership 25 years ago, 25, 26, they may have said, but can I still stay with this wonderful group of people whom I love dearly, even if I feel like, because of pressure from my boss, I have to work occasionally on the Sabbath, or if I really, really, really missed ham and shrimp and all those years? Is it okay if I have some of that now? Or, you know, it's always been tight. The tithing has always been a tough thing for me. If I give, you know, 7% instead of 10. And if, from an authoritative figure, the answer is, yes, that's okay now. Can you see why some people said, oh, good, nothing has changed? It depended on what the motivation was. For some, and I would suspect for us here, we would say to those same posited changes, we would say, but everything has changed. But for some, they literally said, nothing's changed because the group is still intact. Do you see? But what changed was the reason for doing what you do. We would say everything had changed, but not from their vantage point. Because their vantage point was on relationships that they had formed with some wonderful people. And nobody would question that at all. But it was not on a fixed code of conduct that we usually refer to as the law of God, which is a fixed code of conduct. You know, how many scriptures say, I am the eternal, therefore I change not. God told through one of the Old Testament minor prophets. And Jesus, and Hebrews, what is it, 13:8? Jesus Christ, the same yesterday, today, and forever. That's a fixed code of conduct. It doesn't matter what people do. The code from God doesn't change. Now, things changed anyway, of course, even for people like that, tragically and sadly, because the reasons people obeyed had a certain set of guidelines that were varied, and so inevitably things changed. That's why I mentioned from 150,000 down to multiple groups, adding up to maybe 30, who have basically the same pattern of belief that you and I have. That kind of obedience that I'm describing is identification. Now, if that's still not where we want to be, and I think we here would say it's not, then why? Why doesn't that work? Because often it means that people who obey because they identify with people with them, with relationships, are sometimes willing to compromise their principles in order to maintain their relationships. You ever been put in a spot like that, maybe not related to your obedience to God? What if you have a close friend who begins to drift into unsavory conduct, maybe even illegal or unlawful conduct? The question then facing you is, will I join them in that kind of illegal, wrongful conduct in order to maintain the friendship? Or will I say, I'm not going there. I'm sorry that you're choosing this. I don't think it's smart. I don't think it's wise. I don't think it's right. I still care for you as a person, but I am not going to walk that way with you. Do you see the difference? It happens in our society all the time. All the time. What is God's view? Matthew chapter 10. Matthew chapter 10. And verse 34, Jesus' own words. Verse 33 says, whoever denies me before men, him I will deny before my Father who's in heaven. Do not think that I came to bring peace on earth. Isn't that what people think sometimes? Even sing about it in a season we just got through? I did not come to bring peace, but a sword. I have come to set a man against his father, a daughter against her mother, a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. A man's enemies will be those of his own household. Why did he say that? He's talking about a situation where close relationships are faced with a crisis because one party in the relationship changes conduct. And when that happens, the other one is faced with, am I motivated by the relationship or am I motivated by a fixed code of conduct? That's the difference. A man's enemies will be those of his own household. Sadly, tragically, that sometimes happens. Not always, but sometimes. He who loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. This is sort of Matthew's variation of Luke 14 and counting the cost. He who loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. And he who does not take his cross and follow after me is not worthy of me. He who finds his life will lose it. But he who loses his life for my sake will find it. Those are Jesus Christ's own words. And I think he's rather clear on the matter. Third motivation for obedience. Internalization. Internalization. Eventually, brethren, as we mature spiritually, how and why does God want us to obey him? Is obedience enough? I think you can see from the first two kinds of obedience we've talked about, the answer is no. It's not. You can probably think of a few scriptures. We already read Deuteronomy 5:29, where God said, "Oh, that there were such a heart in them." What about Micah 6 and verse 8? He says, "What does the Eternal want?" And he lists it. He lists what God wants. Micah 6 and verse 8. It's 6:8. He has shown you, O man, what is good. What does the Eternal require of you but to do justly, to love mercy or loving kindness, and to walk humbly with your God? It's not about relationships, except with him. It's not about compliance. It's about internalization. What about Acts 13:22? How does it describe King David, despite some of his whoppers? A man after God's own heart, to do or to fulfill all my will. But I mentioned earlier in the sermon that this was often based on some research Mr. David Johnson did in the book of Galatians. So let's go there, to the book of Galatians. Chapter 3, this section of Scripture is one that many who profess to be Christians use to attempt to explain or say or prove that the law is not binding on us. Now, they wouldn't say that all parts of the law are bad. Usually it comes down to there's just one commandment that they really don't want to keep. That's the fourth one about the Sabbath. But the common phrase that is often used is, we are not under law, but under grace. And they misunderstand what Paul says. First of all, I think we should understand something about Paul's use of the word law here in Galatians. He was writing, for the most part, in Greek. Although parts of the New Testament are in Aramaic. But most of it's in Greek, originally. We should understand that the word law in these verses is a general term. Much like we use it in English. If you say, well, the law says, you'd have to explain what law. You know, we have a lawyer here in the congregation. You can ask him, what law are we talking about? If you ask him, can you do this for me? You're a lawyer. He would tell you, well, here's my area of expertise. I'm not that acquainted with what you're talking about. And that would be a fair answer. But it's a general term. Which law is under discussion is determined by the context here and in the whole Bible. For example, look at verses 17 and 18. And this I say, that the law, which was 430 years later, cannot annul the covenant that was confirmed before by God in Christ, that it should make the promise of no effect. Now, what promise is he talking about? Well, if you go back a few verses, you find that he's talking about the promises to Abraham, which were then passed on down to Isaac, to Jacob, and through his children split, some to Joseph and some to Judah. Certain specific promises went one way, other specific promises went the other way. Anyway, if the inheritance is of the law, then it's no longer of promise. But God gave it to Abraham by promise, the inheritance, that is. So which law is he talking about? Verse 24 goes on to say, therefore the law was our tutor, or the old King James says schoolmaster, to bring us to Christ that we might be justified by faith. But after faith has come, we are no longer under a tutor or a schoolmaster. You're all sons of God through faith in Jesus Christ. Okay, what's he talking about? Now, first of all, there's a problem with trying to use these verses to say, well, we're not under law, we're under grace, as if those two are opposites and cannot work in harmony and in tandem, because in fact they do and can. Of course we're under grace. God's undeserved and unmerited pardon, because he applies Jesus Christ's death to pay the penalty for our breaking of the law. We should have to pay for it. But he says, I will allow his death. That'll wake you up. That will allow his death to pay for your sins. But, first of all, the same man wrote in Romans 5, verses 12 and 13, these words, I won't turn there. Therefore, just as through one man sin entered the world, and death through sin, and thus death spread to all men because all sin, for until the law, sin was in the world. But sin is not imputed when there is no law. So if you go back to Galatians chapter 3 here, where it says in verse 17, the law, which was 430 years later, what law are we talking about? Are we talking about the Ten Commandments? Well, we can't be. Remember, the world was destroyed even well before Abraham in Noah's day because of what? Because of sin. Therefore, we can't be talking about the basic law of God that is encapsulated in the Ten Commandments. We can't be. Because it wasn't added 430 years after Abraham. What was added about 430 years after Abraham was in Egypt? The sacrificial law. The law of the Levites serving in the priesthood. That was added about 430 years. That works. That fits. It answers to the context. It also serves as an illustration of the difference between that set of statutes and the promises made to Abraham. That works. That fits. Law of God, if we're talking law of God meaning Ten Commandments, that can't possibly be under discussion here. Verse 13 specifically says sin is not imputed, in Romans 5 that is, it is not imputed, which means counted as being present, if there's no law. God could not have destroyed the world for sin in the days of Noah if there was no such thing as sin. And there wouldn't have been any such thing as sin if there was no such thing as law by God's own standards. It doesn't make sense. So in a context, what's Paul talking about in Galatians 3? He must be referring to the sacrificial law. Because surely enough, that was put in place about 430 years after Abraham was in Egypt. And of course, verse 18 refers to Abraham and the promise and the covenants referred to in verse 17. Now, ask yourself, how could this law of the sacrifices... There was actually a book we used to read in college to study outside, so it was called The Law of the Sacrifices. It was the name of the book. How could that be added because of transgressions if no law existed before Mount Sinai, before the Ten Commandments were thundered from the mountain? You can't do that. If there was no law before Sinai, how could there have been transgressions? Now, some point out, maybe rightly so, that Paul must have shifted gears a little bit by the time he gets to verses 23 and 24, because now he says we and us. He's not talking about Abraham. Okay, fair point. He has shifted gears a little bit. He talks about we, for us, before faith came, we were kept under guard by the law, kept for the faith, which would have afterward be revealed. The law was our tutor, our schoolmaster to bring us to Christ, that we might be justified by faith. Okay, he's talking about New Testament Christians. I get it. Fair enough. But does that prove that the law, meaning especially now the Ten Commandments, is done away? You'd have a hard time selling that when you compare Paul's writing in Romans 7, where he said the law is holy and the commandment is holy and just and good. Same man. So what did Paul mean in Galatians 3? Let's dig a little deeper. Try this one on for size. The word that he uses in verses 24 and 25, tutor or schoolmaster in the Old King James, isn't interesting. Well, it's pedagogos or pedagogos in Greek. P-A-I-D-A-G-O-G-O-S. By implication, we get the English word pedagogue or pedagogy. Ask my wife what the study of piano pedagogy is. It's a study of the piano's the skills in a certain way. The two Greek words are related. Pedagogos or pedagogo, bogogu, G-O-U-E. There are only three times in the entire New Testament that any form of that basic Greek word is used. Just three times. Two of them right here, verses 24 and 25. The other time is in 1 Corinthians 4:15. Do you know what it's translated there? It's translated as instructors. Instructors. Now, because the word is only used three times in the entire New Testament, it's a little hard to get a full understanding of what it means because of the way languages shift in translation. It'll be helpful in this case to ask the question, how was it used back in that time in the general Greek world, the general Greek use? It'd help us to understand, in other words, what was the mind of Paul's audience when they heard him use this word, which he only used three times, twice here and once to the Corinthians. What would they have understood as they heard him use a word that was kind of rare? How would the people Paul wrote to have understood it? That's probably the second rule of Bible study. First is context, but if there's limited context, three words in the New Testament, next is how would it have been understood by the people to whom it was written back then? The word as it was used in Greek literature and culture meant a child leader or a trainer of boys. That was the common usage. In other words, it was a servant in a well-to-do household who accompanied the boys to school or wherever they went when they were outside the house. Please remember, for the Greek culture of the time, girls were not educated in the same way. We would totally disagree with that now. We would take a different approach. But the question is, how would it have been understood back then? So he was a child leader or a trainer of boys. This servant was an extremely trustworthy person, and he was entrusted with guarding the morals and the safety of the boy. He was kind of like a chaperone. Vine's dictionary says this about the word and its meaning. In this and allied or related words, the idea is of training and discipline, not of the impartation of knowledge. We're not talking about a teacher in a classroom. We're talking about a chaperone. Someone who looks after, as it says, the training and discipline, not the impartation of knowledge. The pedagogos was not the instructor of the child. That would have been the Greek word didaskalos, different word. But he exercised a general supervision over him and was responsible for his moral and physical well-being. Do we see what Paul's driving at when we know what the word meant to the people who read it? They said, oh, I get it. The law was our child leader. The law was our trainer of boys. I get it. In the first place, when he says we are justified by faith, that we ought to understand. The purpose of God's law, the purpose of any law, is to show us what the right standard of conduct is, to tell you what the rules are. That's what a law does. Go all the way back to our, you know, speed limit laws. It is not to make us righteous before God. That's not why God's law is in existence. It tells us what righteousness is. Making us righteous is a different process. It's called justification in the Bible, where God applies the sacrifice of His Son, Jesus Christ, His death, to pay the penalty for our sins. And He justifies us, makes us right, or makes us righteous by applying His Son's perfect sacrifice. But then what purpose does God's holy and righteous and good law, as Paul called it, serve? Especially when we're still learning and we haven't yet moved very much beyond compliance or maybe identification levels of obedience. It is, as Paul says, our tutor, our schoolmaster, our trainer of children, our child leader. It tells us what's right and wrong. It's like the chaperone saying, you can't do that. You got to be in by 11 o'clock tonight, and so on. It guards us from harm by pointing out what sinful and therefore dangerous behavior is until we can move on to internalization. Until we have that law in our hearts and minds. One more observation. One more question. What do you think happened in Greek homes, society, to the child leader or the instructor of boys, trainer of boys, when all the boys in the family grew up and became adults? What do you think happened then to the pedagogos? Did they take him out and shoot him? Well, metaphorically, they didn't have guns, but you know what I mean. Of course not. That's a silly question. Remember, he was one of the most trusted servants in the household. He was given maybe the most important task of any servant in the household in guarding the future of the family. He was simply reassigned to some equally important task. Maybe he became the chief steward, for example, if the position became available and if his talents suited it. So, should we assume, by that same reasoning that is sometimes employed, that we should take God's law out and shoot it once we have internalized how we ought to live ourselves? What a ridiculous suggestion. When we mature spiritually to the point that we are actually internalizing God's mind and way of thinking and making it our own, when we develop more and more of the mind of Christ, Philippians 2 and verse 5, how ridiculous would that be? The law shows us how God thinks. It's His standard of conduct. When the very mind that we are developing lived completely and perfectly according to that righteous standard and never once transgressed it, never sinning, and we're told that He is our example, why would we ever set it aside? In that light, Paul's statement in Galatians 3:25 doesn't need to cause us confusion. When he says that when faith has come, we are no longer under a tutor, it makes perfect sense. We no longer operate strictly out of fear of the consequences. In other words, we don't go around saying, what will the child leader tell my dad if I mess up? We don't take that approach anymore. Our approach is, what is the right thing to do? It's a very different approach. We have come to have more and more of the mind of Christ, and we obey not out of fear of the consequences or even because our friends are doing it, but out of deeply held convictions and conversion and desire to please God with the knowledge that this is His truth. This all came to mind because, brethren, in the last few days, I've thought about the fact that even with just a brief friendship of 3.5 years, that's what I was seeing in Blanche Smith. That's what I was seeing. Even through the haze of her trial. And of course, what Paul cannot possibly have meant here is that God's standards of right and wrong have changed. Jesus Christ, the same yesterday, today, and forever. Old Testament. I am the eternal. I have not changed. Therefore, you sons of Jacob are not consumed. In that light, there's a marvelous connection to our deepening understanding and yielding more and more perfectly to God. We won't do it perfectly in this life because we're human and fallible, prone to mistakes and sins. It's called repentance. Not a one-time emotional event so you can feel better about your life, quoting from an article on Life Hope and Truth. It is instead, as the same article says, a process designed to continually change your life. It's from an article called How to Repent on Life Hope and Truth. The article goes on to say, repentance is a godly sorrow that is so deep and profound that it leads to our diligently changing our lives. Or perhaps we could say, after today, moving from compliance to identification to internalization. When we understand what obedience to God really means, our lives change. I thought about that this past week in summing up the life of a faithful woman whom I knew only a little compared to those who were there at her funeral to pay their respects who had known her for decades. As she knew, God called her to faithfully follow his way of life, not in a superficial way due to only compliance or even identification, but changes in the deepest and most intimate levels of who she was, to paraphrase the quote from the article. Why? Because Blanche Smith, I believe, was obedient to God because she had internalized God's way. That's what I saw. That's why my wife saw as well. At first, in many lives, our obedience may be mostly from compliance, a kind of fear of the consequences of disobedience. But gradually, the motivation to obey shifts in subtle ways. We still have a deep and proper awe of God, what the Bible calls the fear of the eternal. And yes, we do find that we have a special bond with those who are of like mind, the phrase we often use. Yes, we do form special relationships with each other. Just as Jesus Christ told his disciples, he says that you'll have mothers and fathers and brothers and sisters in the faith. But that's still not the deepest level. As we grow and mature in God's way of life, we begin to think like Jesus Christ. Well, not perfectly, not all the time. When that guy goes flying past you on the freeway doing 90, you know. Mr. Dave Myers, my good friend, says he's trained himself now to say, I sure hope your mother's going to be okay because you must be rushing to the hospital to get to her bedside. So now when we have a, I look at my wife and I say, I sure hope his mom's going to be okay. Anyway, we don't do it perfectly and we don't do it all the time. We still have a lot of gaps in our pattern of living. Blanche Smith did, I do, so do you. We're human. But we repent before God. When we see our sins, we get up and we go on. We are internalizing this way of life, of thinking, of living, of being. This is who we are and, more to the point, who we want to be. Thank you all for bearing with thoughts from a celebration of a life and 4 days of travel. Now it's off to Meadville. Have a great rest of the Sabbath.